Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Feast, have fun! Hello, I'm Rich Herring. You're about to watch or listen to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my guest Steve Coogan. How cool is that? This week's show is sponsored by Go Faster Stripe, who also make this podcast. How did they get to sponsor it as well? They must have paid millions. They did. If you go to gofasterstripe.com, you can buy fantastic DVDs from loads of artists, like the actor Kevin Eldon, brilliant people, Tony Law, Fist of Fun, Leon Herring's Fist of Fun. You can get all sorts of fantastic people. My DVDs you can get, at the moment they're having this fantastic sale. If you go to gofasterstripe.com/sale, you can get lots of DVDs from like Andrew Collins. His audiobook has been slashed, the price of that has been slashed. It's unbelievable, and people have fallen over themselves to buy it. Sold like about 400,000 more copies than it had before. Anyway, you can get, like, for example, my book Talking Cock is in the sale. That's £12 normally, and Chris Evans, I said, oh well, maybe put it on for £11.50. Chris Evans said, no, I've gone insane. I'm going to put it on for less than that. I said, well, what, £4? He said, no, I'm so insane, I'm putting it on for £3. That is genuinely, I mean, I'm worried he should be committed. Seriously, this isn't an advert for the produce. This is me worried for the sanity of a man who, you know, I'd almost call my friend. So go to gofasterstripe.com/sale to buy some sale items, or a badge. You can buy a badge to help fund this stuff, or go to gofasterstripe.com and buy something at full price, which will be much better for us, to be honest. Anyway, here now is the Steve Coogan and me talking about some shit. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who yesterday ran 13.1 miles and is slightly stiff. Please welcome, nothing to do with the running. Please welcome Richard Herring. Still got it, so thank you. Hello. Hello, lovely to see you all. Thank you for coming. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rahelastapur. Oh, lots of cool kids in today. I did the Royal Parks Half Marathon yesterday, which last year I did in 2 hours, 37 minutes and 41 seconds. This year I did it in 1 hour, 47 minutes and 9 seconds, which was 50 minutes faster. So that's... look at me still... I'm really sad. I don't know why I'm doing that. It's just once I got off stage, I'm going to be very upset with myself for jumping around so much. That is to say, it's not really fair to say I did that because Me Too did run the race. So that is... He did very well. It's 8 minutes off. That's 8 minutes off my personal best from 10.5 years ago. That is ridiculous. I'm a young man. I'm never going to die. That is definitely the case. He couldn't. This is our 50th podcast that we've done this series. So we've got a very special guest to celebrate that. It's not just a coincidence. And I won't mess around too much because I wanted to talk to him really. But yesterday after I'd run the half marathon, I watched the film, which I hadn't seen before, The Wolf of Wall Street. I don't know if anyone's seen the Wolf of Wall Street. I tell you, it's one of the worst werewolf films I have ever seen. You see, it has you in suspense. You think, when's the werewolf going to turn up? This is, because I tell you, it's full of absolute cunts. Every single person, they've set up brilliantly. You think, well, who's going to, I mean, I don't know which one I want to die first. I can't wait to see him have his throat ripped out. Maybe that little dwarf's going to turn into a werewolf. That would be apt. Or the woman who has her hair shaved off for 10,000. They're idiots, these stockbrokers. They don't know how to eat sherbet at all. You eat sherbet with your mouth through a licorice stick, mate. Suck it up like that. You do not eat it with your mouth off of a lady's bottom. That is just weird. That is unhygienic way to eat sherbet. So please be careful with it. Good, that's my Wolf of Wall Street material. I feel there was something else, but fuck it. Our guest today is a man who makes the Wolf of Wall Street's lifestyle. Look, excessive. That's all of our lives do. He is best known, of course, as Tommy from The Indian in My Cupboard. Quite a controversially racist show. And he was also, of course, you'll remember him from his funny impressions he did in the W.H. Smith's advert in about 1990. That is what I remember him from. Will you please welcome Steve Coogan, ladies and gentlemen? Steve fucking Coogan. Steve Coogan. Welcome. Sit down. Hello, sit down. How do you do? Come on in. Steve, it's Steve Coogan. Yeah, you're all very excited, but it started well with Stephen Merchant as well, didn't it? So just let's not get over the top. So, what about the Indian in My Cupboard? What do you remember about playing Tommy in the Indian in My Cupboard? And who was the Indian in the Cupboard?
It was called the Indian in the Cupboard.
Okay, right.
And it was actually a Native American in a cupboard.
Oh, okay, that's much better than...
It's a better title, isn't it?
Yeah.
I played a toy soldier called Tommy Atkins.
Do you?
Yeah.
You're quite like that's the role you've specialised
like,
in
I,
over
I,
your
well,
career.
I played a miniature person, yeah. And I decided after that I wanted to do more miniature people. And Night at the Museum, I also play a miniature soldier. So I've done the 4 miniature soldiers in films.
Interesting. It's good to know that if they have that role, you can call on Steve Coogan and he knows.
Well, because Alan Partridge is successful, but you can't take anything for granted, so it's good to have something to fall back on.
Yeah.
So small soldiers.
Yeah. How did you... It was Octavius you played in Night at the Museum. How did you prepare for a role like that of being a tiny Roman...
Obviously,
soldier.
I visited Rome.
Yeah.
Went to the Colosseum.
Yeah.
Bought some ice cream. Closed my eyes and really imagined what it would be like to be a Roman centurion.
Yeah.
And, So, no, you just... That's really is... You really don't think when you play those... I mean, this doesn't make... It makes no sense at all. I have this English accent in it. I mean, really, I should be speaking in Latin, shouldn't I? Right.
Although he isn't actually a Roman soldier. He's a representation of a Roman soldier. So you can do it however you like.
That is true, actually. He's supposed to be a small plastic Roman soldier that comes... I mean, once you've gone past that point of a toy soldier in a diorama that comes to life, I think you can more or less do what you like.
And do you remember the first thing I ever saw you in, and I thought you were amazing in, was the W.H. Smith's adverts, your face, was you coming up going, Betty,
the thing is, because of YouTube, these things are sort of people put them out there. In fact, I sometimes go, I wonder if that's on you. Oh my God, someone's actually put that up. I did this W.H. Smith ad, and it was really, and I was very excited at the time, because it was like, it was television. Yeah. Mm. And it was me just doing various impersonations. And it had lines like, things like me doing Tommy Cooper saying, this is about what's for sale at WSF going, CDs, and those. Things like that, just really shit jokes like that. And then me as Paul Daniels going, hello, like I'm really small, because he's quite small.
It's good. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty groundbreaking stuff at the time.
You stuck with that.
That was the turning point for me.
And then I met you in real life shortly after that, and I was like the actual bloke from the W.H. Smith advert.
Yeah.
It was very exciting, because we worked together on The Hour.
We worked together on The Hour.
Yeah.
And we did The Dumb Show in Edinburgh.
The Dumb Show.
We did a show in Edinburgh in 1992.
Yeah.
You, me, Patrick Marber, Simon Munnery, and Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
And I remember Stuart Lee telling us off for messing about on the last night. Well, being quite cross, actually.
I don't remember that.
Take it seriously.
Maybe if he'd done that on the first night, it would have been a good show.
Yeah.
Seems a bit late. It was kind of an amazing, you know. Looking back, it was a.
Well, I wasn't that the audience didn't find it funny. I just thought we were way ahead of them.
We were. There was some funny stuff in there, but it was a clash of personalities in some ways.
Yeah.
Let's say.
Oh, but did I say Patrick Marber? Do we mention Patrick?
I saw
Patrick
him.
Was in it.
Yeah, Patrick.
That's what, yeah.
Yeah, but it was a clash between Patrick Marber and everyone else. That was the clash.
Sort of.
Like, well, no, you were getting on with Patrick.
I knew which side my bread was buttered. I knew he could write comedy, and I wanted to write for me, so I had to behave myself.
His mate chose the wrong person. But on the and then on The Hour, which sort of came out after that, because you won the Perrier Award that year with a different show, unbelievably.
Yeah. One thing is, I have my show I did with my northern friend, John Thompson, and then my show I did with my Oxbridge friends, who'd let me join their exclusive club with you and that lot. And that's right. And then after we did, but Patrick did direct my Edinburgh show.
Yeah.
He said, give me £1,000, I'll direct it. So a lot of money in those days.
It was.
And then we did On The Hour with Armando.
Yeah. Which, again, was another kind of thing. At the time, I think we didn't quite realise, it was special at the time, but when you look back with Chris Morris and you, Patrick Marber, Rebecca Front, Amanda Iannucci. Yeah.
I remember at the time when they were doing those sketches, and I remember coming in the first day and reading some of those sketches, and before that I'd done sort of very, sort of, sort of comedy characters that were very... how can I put this? Orthodox or sort of very old-fashioned in the comedy style. And when I met Armando, and also you and Stuart wrote these very surreal kind of sketches.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking they were so funny and really different and edgy. And I remember thinking this is going to be big.
It did. It was quite. And of course, at that time, I created the. the character of Alan Partridge around that time.
Shall I clear this up? Yeah. Richard and Stuart wrote a sketch that said sports report presenter. Just said I don't even say generic. Just said sports presenter. And Armand said, can you do a voice? And I went, they all sound the same to me. They all sound a bit like this. And I did this kind of like voice like this, a bit like John Watson, but it was a bit like that sort of thing. And we did this sketch. And then, so in some ways, you could say that the first material I did as Alan was material written by you. But of course...
And therefore, we followed that through to its logical conclusion.
And it was very, very surreal. But then after that, we thought, well, this is a good voice. Forget the material. How can we develop it into something three-dimensional and alive? And that's when Alan started to be born. Yeah.
If you give me £250,000 right now, we'll call it even. How about that? We won't go through the course.
I'm not charging you for tonight, so that's what that is.
You are getting paid £250 tonight.
It's all going to a controversial political cause.
So I'm going to ask you an emergency question just to get us out of the slight tension that's been created mainly by me.
I like the tension. It's good tension.
It was. I like it when it's good. It's exciting.
It's interesting.
Tension.
It's not funny, but it's dramatic.
It is. And that's what you're more into now.
That's right, I'm very serious now.
You are a very serious man.
So if you're not laughing, it's because I'm choosing to be serious.
Okay. You can answer this question seriously. If you had to choose between having sex with a man who was a 6 foot tall penis with a face, or having sex with a man who, instead of having a penis, in the place of that, he had a very tiny man, just which of those two? If you have to have sex with one of them, which one would you have sex with?
Well, I mean,
so it's a 6 foot tall penis, but he's wearing a false shoulder suit, so he looks like a man.
Yeah, but the thing is,
and he's got a face here.
Yeah, but he's an actual penis.
He's a six foot tall penis.
Well, that means that he's not got any details. He's just a penis.
Has the penis got
a penis?
No.
Well, that to me, that's just. I mean, all I could do is just rub him up and down.
You could. You could insert your penis into his blowhole, as I believe it's called.
Yeah, but it's too... No, I couldn't do that. The other one is more interesting to me.
Yeah, okay.
What was he like? He's got a penis.
He's a man, but he's got a small man.
A small man, effectively, can function as a penis.
He can do. I mean, it would be a cruel way to treat him. I mean, in a way, he's like an Indian in the cupboard, isn't he?
When you say full sex, would I have to penetrate myself with the small man? Or could I just rub the man up and down?
You can do anything. I mean, with consent, you can do anything. But you would have to get the consent of the man and the tiny man as well. They're both together. Yeah. So if one of them said no, one person saying yes and one person saying no means no.
Obviously, a discussion would have to ensue about what was acceptable to both of them.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't want to, force myself on either of them. I'd want if they're both in agreement. It's got to be consensual.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. Talking of dicks, you were quite outspoken about Jeremy Clarkson, which was
which was quite a
good thing to say. This was on his previous to last aberration.
They all had to go to Mexico. Well, see, what annoyed me about it was what's doubly annoying about it was I've been on the show 3 times, and even though I've done lots and lots of work over the last 25 years, if I'm in America somewhere or somewhere where I think, I might be recognised for something other than Alan Partridge, people come up to me and say, hey, you doing any more Top Gear? and that's all they know me from is Top Gear. But I say, I don't think they're going to invite me back because I attack them for being racist. And they go, they're funny guys, aren't they? they are sometimes. But I actually said, I attacked them because I thought they were being racist about something. Yeah, they're pretty funny. Yeah, but I just think they're a bit racist, that's all. Yeah, but those guys are pretty funny, right? Well, the thing was, I wouldn't mind, but it's just rubbish comedy that they do. And what annoyed me was, because sometimes you think, well, there's no point saying anything about all this. But then what annoyed me was they said, well, it's just people who've got no sense of humour that think it's offensive. And I thought, so I said, would they have said the same thing if it had been Jews or Pakistanis?
Yeah.
And because there's no big wave of Mexicans in Britain, they thought they could do it with impunity. It's like cowardly racism.
Did you choose the word wave there on purpose?
Yeah, because of Mexico. Oh, no. You've discovered I'm a secret racist. they didn't, but that works. It works.
Yeah.
The wave thing.
It does. What do you know?
It works. I had to go because I said, well, it stops. I said, and they all think I'm funny when I'm Alan Partridge.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, if I say I don't think you're funny, then they can't turn around and go, well, you don't know anything about comedy. And they sort of went, oh, well. Blah.
It didn't stop them though, did it? Because they've carried on with the same.
I know. It's like, well, look, it's billions of people think they're funny, but so and I just go, one small person going, no, you're not. That's all it is, really, isn't it? But they didn't ask me back on the show.
But it's because you like driving cars.
I do like driving cars.
It's the same kind of person as that's. Does that worry you?
It does worry me because I'm a bit torn about it because I'm embarrassed about the fact that I like cars. It's a bit of an affliction. I sort of, on the one hand, because and also, I even though I like cars, Everybody else who likes cars, I think, is a dick. Because they mostly are dicks. And when I buy a car magazine, I sort of hide it inside a porn magazine. I'm too embarrassed about it, you know. And if I'm on the train, yeah. I'll read it on my lap under the table because I feel like I don't... Because I think it's a bit sad.
Yeah. But do you take the train? You're taking the train home tonight, like a normal person would.
Yeah, I do. I said to you earlier, if I go into the office, I do get the tube two stops. But I was going home back to Brighton one night getting off the tube and going across Victoria to get on the train, and this woman came up to me and said, "I love that you use public transport." And I said, "Good. Tell people."
Do people recognise you much? Is it in real life? Are you sorry? You're getting dripped on here as well. This happened last week. We should have really sorted it out. There's a
is it actually literally dripping on?
There's some kind of awful cholera-ridden Ebola virus.
Okay,
just adds an extra frisson to the. It's only on your side.
That's fine. So, what was the question?
Do people recognise you? Because obviously, like, you don't look. You look a bit like
Well,
Alan Partridge.
I'm dressed as a teacher tonight.
You are.
For fun. I do and I don't. I mean, you sort of, you know, if you... thing is, if you don't want... What you do is you avoid eye contact and keep moving.
Yeah.
And also, if I can spot my demographic, like sort of men aged between 20 and 35.
Right.
20 and 40. Then I try and look the other way as I walk past them. But
is it sort of guys there?
Yeah, those sorts of people. Yeah,
yeah.
I look the other way, but I do get recognised, and I just don't make a fuss. But people do. Sometimes I play a game where people, when they want to recognise you, they want to check that it's you. They sort of do a big. They walk around you in a big loop, and then they walk past you and sort of walk past you, and they sort of look up and go. And what I do is, if I've got a newspaper or something, as they try to walk around, I just casually turn the other way. So they go, "Oh, he's looking the other way now." I can't quite tease. And then they go around again. As they go around, big circle, and I casually turn my back on the other. Just for my own amusement. So, yeah.
That's great. Good.
That's what I do.
Good. There's a bit we do quite regularly, which is I look at this. Have you heard of the website Britcom Confession, Dirty Britcom Confessions, in which comedy fans can go online... and I think you'll like it, Steve. I think you'll enjoy it. And post their fantasies about British comedians.
Oh, I think go on, yeah.
But they're generally quite weird and sort of witty. They're not generally filthy. And yours are. I thought they'd be filthier than they are. Hmm. But here's some of the things people have said about you on Britcom Confessions. Alan Partridge's voice is the key to orgasm. Which, if that's true, that's. Orgasms.
Well, look, it's not that. Some people like people to shit on them, so that's quite mild.
But that makes it sound like nobody can have an orgasm without you coming in and going, "Aha!"
Yeah, it is strange.
It's a strange thing to say. This is someone... I think there's someone else that did a Santa-based one. I think it's the same. From the font, I think it's the same person, whoever the other week was. "Dear Santa, I just want Steve Coogan with a ribbon around his penis. Would you be prepared to do that?"
If it aided erection.
Yeah, well, it would hold.
Like a sort of a festive cock ring.
Yeah, it could hold it. If you get erect and then round the base.
And then sort of haul it like a sort of pulley system. Yeah, that would work.
Good do. Okay, this one's quite rude. "I admire Rowan Atkinson too much to have any dirty thoughts about him." "So I'll just settle for him just to watch Steve Coogan banging me." Would you be...
That's quite nice.
Would you be okay with that? But that also... Wouldn't you be thinking, well, she doesn't respect me, or she or he does not respect me enough to not want me to bang them?
Well, I'd rather be banging her with Rowan Atkinson watching us than Rowan Atkinson fucking her, me watching them.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Rowan Atkinson has the comedic respect in that.
As long as he was watching it, he wasn't in my eye line. Do you know what I mean? If he was behind my shoulder. But I don't want to be making eye contact with him. Like,
he's got quite a naturally funny face. I think it might put you off.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not erotic, is it?
Yeah. "Oh, hello. Have you caveat?"
And I thought this one was a non sequitur, but I think it makes sense. I want to go to Bolton Abbey with Steve Coogan.
Which I think that is sounds like a metaphor.
It does.
Yeah. It's not. She literally means Bolton Abbey, which isn't in Bolton.
Oh, is it not?
No, it's not. It's in the north. But it's a
is
lovely
it like,
abbey.
There's a Leeds castle in the south southeast. It's like that.
There's a Leeds castle that's not in Leeds.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, yeah. There's a long tradition of place of old buildings with place names that's not where they are.
And so, is this somewhere you went on the trip?
It is somewhere we went on the trip in the first.
Did you do anything very sexy there with Rob Brydon?
Not really. No, no. Come on.
I mean, you know, no, I don't know.
That's below the belt. That's sick. but it was very nice. Very nice. Lots of. It's funny, isn't it? There's not because of course Henry VIII sort of destroyed all the abbeys, didn't he?
With
the
huge
act of vandalism by Henry VIII.
But they, you know, they look nice now.
But they do. That's the strange thing is actually they're rather romantic as sort of those ruins.
Yeah. You know.
Lots of buildings should be slightly half demolished,
yeah.
So that moss grow on them and stuff.
And basically, with Rob Brydon, the trip from—I haven't seen all of it, but what I can understand—it's sort of like this podcast, but you do it on the Amalfi Coast and stuff. That is sort of like two blokes dicking around.
Yeah,
we could do. We can do an impression off. I've got some impressions.
Go on.
So I don't know what your Tam Dial's like. Can you do Tam Dial?
I'm angry about something.
He might be Welsh. No, it's this is it.
He's not,
That's what it is. It's book. That's what it is.
Very good.
That is Scottish. That's actually all. That's the only one I can do.
It's very good.
Yeah.
It's very good. Yeah. He's. Go on. I don't know what to say about
no.
that.
No.
Really. But
I could be on instead of Rob Brydon. It could be you and me going eating expensive
meals. It's not very
meals.
Complicated,
yeah.
To be honest with you.
No,
it's just we did one up north, driving around, eating in restaurants, talking, and then we thought let's do one in Italy.
Yeah,
driving around, eating in restaurants, and talking. So,
do you have to eat the same meal like 8 times? For
yeah,
TV?
You do. The hardest thing is when you sort of serve up the same meal, and you have to. The hardest bit of acting actually is when. They want to do one more shot of them putting the full meal down in front of you, and there's two kinds of eating. If you're acting, because we're sort of supposed to be acting, and we try and act within a sort of framework of like, I'll say this, you say that, then I'll say this, and then we'll see what happens. But when you eat with food, I think actors in films do two things. They either push the food around the plate so they don't have to eat it, or they really eat it aggressively as if to say. Look at me, I'm really eating this food. Right. Like gangsters and stuff do that, don't they? Like Sopranos, they sort of eat the food, don't they? It's like, as they're talking. But we would eat it because it was just so tasty. And then of course, they keep serving it. And eventually, even though however tasty it is, you get full. And the hardest acting is when they put the meal down in front of you and it's a full meal and you're stuffed and you have to go, that looks lovely. Because you know, they say you shouldn't go to the supermarket on an empty stomach because you buy loads of shit. Well, the reverse is true, because I actually went shopping in this Booths, which is a lovely supermarket up north in Cumbria.
I know it, yeah.
And I had sausage and mash before I went shopping.
Yes.
And the opposite is true. I didn't want to put anything in the basket.
It's true.
So, oh, God, no. So, just an interesting observation. I thought you could work that into one of your routines.
I'll do it. Thank you. Well... Funny enough, I gave Steve an idea for... I mean, there are actually some ideas that might in Alan Partridge, but there genuinely are. I think we've just come before. But before the podcast, it was raining, and I walked in my shoes. Steve gave me some advice. You have to be a monthly subscriber to find out what his advice was, though. But my socks got really wet, so I put... As I was putting them in the... I realised there's a dryer backstage, so as I was putting my socks in the dryer, Steve arrived from the backstage entrance, saw me putting socks in a dryer, which was quite embarrassing, and I said, you know, you could... Put this in one of your Alan Partridge scripts, couldn't you? Sorry, I'm putting my socks in a dryer. You go, yeah, it's all right.
And then it went, very quiet, didn't it?
Yeah.
A hush descended.
It did go, because then it's embarrassing being caught putting socks in a dryer.
Yeah.
Just, you know, knocking about.
I thought you'd say some new thing like the comic with bare feet.
Yeah, because I hadn't bare feet, but actually I thought this is terrible. This is just for you, the people here. I had really wet socks, so this is going to be terrible. We have to do the show in wet socks. But now I've got really warm socks. It was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
I thought it was like I've got a suit, so I'm a bit corporate, but yeah. I'm fucking it all up and being anarchic because I'm not wearing shoes. So that's the anarchic bit of it.
It's it like is, playing. And it's another reference to earlier podcasts in the series. It's like Paul McCartney on the Abbey Road. He wears a suit and bare feet, and because he is dead, apparently. There's two bits in Alan Partridge that are based on me and Stu that Peter Bainham, who we may should talk about, stole. Which is the bit where someone comes up to you and says, "Are you Alan Partridge? You've dropped your car. You've dropped your credit card or whatever it is." That actually happened to me. It wasn't Alan Partridge. It was a you, Richard Herring. And I went, "Yeah." And I went, "Yeah, I am." He went, "There's, you've dropped your credit card." And Peter Payneham stole that from my life.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, yeah, he might have done that. He is a thief.
He is a thief. And the other one is when Alan Partridge goes to the fan's house and it's full of effigies of him and the posters on the wall. That essentially happened to Stuart Lee.
Really?
Yeah, he went. Stuart Lee went to a gig. He got locked out of his bread and breakfast. There's a brilliant punchline to this as well. This beyond the joke. I've just remembered.
I hope so.
Let's hope so. When I say punchline, I'm an extra.
An extra bit.
This guy had been at the gig. Drove and said, "Oh, we'd come and we've got a spare bed in our house. Come and sleep there." So she said, "Fine." And then he got to the house, and they didn't have a spare bedroom. What they had is a mattress on the floor of the living room. The living room had posters of Stuart Lee's, all of his shows
really?
Up, yeah. And the guy's flatmates were watching the porn version of Animal Farm in the lounge. So Stuart had to lie on this thing with posters of himself up on the wall. And years later, it turned out the guy who'd invited Stu back to his flat was the DJ Christine O'Connell. So, I told you it was a great punchline to the...
Wow.
Who had posters of, and then Christine O'Connell, who I've asked about this, says, "We had posters of loads of comedians up, it wasn't just Stu." That's quite scary. So that's you.
It wouldn't have sounded as good if Stuart had said, "I stayed in this flat," and they had posters of many, many people, some of which were me. Right?
There was no effigy, but there we go. Cool. So let's talk about the Leveson inquiry, because that was like all serious as well.
That was very serious.
It was.
Yeah.
But that's so you had your phone hacked.
Well,
do you know for sure you did, or do you? Just...
Well, no, I guessed. Yeah. I guessed that I did because I had. I looked at Glenn Mulcair's notebook because the police sent it to me because I asked them to, and it had lots of phone numbers in it and had the password to my phone account,
right?
Which is Ferrari, which I changed. Because I didn't want that getting out. Please don't tell anyone. I went along to Leveson to.
Have you changed it to boobs, Steve? Is that what it is?
Boobs. It's an old fashioned word. Like, not tits, that would be too rude. Boobs. So I did the Leveson. It was very funny because what they do is when they ask you questions at Leveson, they try to sort of catch you out a bit.
Yeah.
And what they do is when a lawyer asks you a question, they use the silence and hope that you'll fill the silence and in sort of say something slightly incriminating. So they'll say, I remember this, the guy who was doing sort of the cross-examination said, "Now you say that you saw a, you say that, not Glenn Mulcair, this other guy, Paul McMullen, who was one of these sort of rather feral-like journalists, and he said, you say that he was photographing it outside your house." Yes, that's right. "How do you know this?" "He told me." "He told you?" "Yes." "I see." "And just turn the pages, you've got to wait for you to fill in." And he said, "And you say you saw someone rifling through your rubbish bins?" "Yes." "How do you know this?" "I saw them." "You saw them?" "Yes." "What, you just saw them one evening?" "It was the morning." And then the other thing they did was he asked me about Piers. He said, "You were interviewed by Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan says, I met Steve Coogan at one of these excruciatingly trendy London clubs." And I said, "He chose the venue." and he got a big laugh like that. And he sort of went... I was like, yes. Give me another.
So you've been through all of this and hacked off, which you're involved with. Their new rules have come in. Which is interesting because I write a weekly column, a humorous weekly column for the Metro newspaper, which is owned by the Daily Mail Group, which I didn't realise that before I started writing for it, but now I know. But because I wrote for them, even though I don't write, I just write stupid shit things that happen to me in my life, that I had to go in for a special seminar about about it all, about the changes, and they were really, the man from the Daily Mail who took the seminar was really pissed off with Hacked Off, and he's going, he's talking about you all Hacked Off. And I was the probably only person in the room siding with you amongst all the Daily Mail. Oh, they've changed everything. You've got to be careful, and you mustn't do this. So we now have to be double careful. We have to check everything that is true and stuff before we put it in.
Well, the thing is, they don't want things like they sort of claim what they do is they try and say it was like we're anti freedom of speech and all that, of course. No, we're not. But so they say the one thing they accuse of is we want sort of, you know, and also the reason I got involved really was it's slightly problematic because obviously if someone like me gets involved, you go, oh, well, you just got an axe to grind because they said nasty things about you. And you go, well, no, it's not that. It's because actually, you know, I don't like sometimes the way the newspapers behave. And I think that people who get fucked over by them should have a proper system of redress, right? That's all, just an effective system of redress. And so they ask, and that means the Dowlers, the McCanns, and all those other people, Christopher Jeffries, people that have all been abused. And you just want a system, a fair system of redress. But you know, we also want to protect public interest journalism. We want to enable it, you know, to help public interest journalists. Yeah. And you know, it's just
even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Sometimes it's like David and Goliath. Sometimes the David is the journalist. Sometimes David is someone who's being screwed over by the press. And one thing I've noticed is that all the people who scream about freedom of the press, the journalists who scream about freedom of the press, don't really say much about plurality. It doesn't bother them that their wages are being paid by Lord Rothermere or the Barclay brothers, if you write for the Telegraph, or all these people who own the newspapers. That threat to freedom of the press doesn't bother them because those threats to freedom of the press pay their wages. Yeah. So they only get upset about people who basically want to complain about things that are said about them that aren't true.
Yeah. It is annoying. I wanted to put my hand up. It was okay. Well, it's annoying for me because I had to go to quite a boring 40-minute seminar, which, you know, at the end I just wanted to say, so what you're saying is as long as I just don't, should we just tell the truth from now? As long as we tell the truth, it will be okay.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because there's and also, but funnily enough, when I appeared before Leveson, I got sort of, well, Hugh Grant got attacked by the Daily Mail the next day, and then I got attacked with it. And it's like we're constantly being attacked. But now it's sort of the kind of, once you, Paul Dacre, who edits the Daily Mail, is whenever I've appeared on TV, we've invited him to come along. In fact, I think we invited him to come along tonight, didn't we, Richard? But, he always says no, because I always think of him as like the man in The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain. you know, that's got a big booming voice that's the Daily Mail.
Yeah.
Going, boom, I'm the Daily Mail. But really, it's just this little man behind the curtain pulling levers saying, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. So when you think of him like that, it stops being scary. But I mean, there's lots of different... The thing about Rupert Murdoch is... He just wants to make money and wants his company to be able to make money unimpeded and write. And if that means writing nasty things, that's fine. Even if it means writing nice things, that's fine. As long as people buy newspapers, he's happy. He doesn't care why they buy. Paul Dacre is different because he's not just about money. He definitely believes all the horrible, shitty crap that he writes in his newspaper. He really does believe it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't like bad language. I don't like talking about people in a disparaging way. But Paul Dacre is a cunt.
So, I'll try and intrude a bit on your personal life now. You often, when actors work together in films, there's like romance and, you know, stuff goes on. So I wondered, in Philomena. Did you, Philomena, as I call it,
yeah.
Did you and Judi Dench get off with each other during the filming of that? Was there anything going on? I think I might have...
Again,
yeah.
I don't like to talk. Nothing like that happened. I mean, she gave me one hand job. in the car.
It's boring, though, isn't it? People think acting's an interesting job, but there's a lot of sitting around doing nothing, and you... So, yeah, they have to film
actually,
the time.
All that I did in between all the takes, all she wanted me to do was do impersonations of Jimmy Savile. And she said, don't tell anyone I like you to. She said, don't tell anyone I like you to do impersonations of Jimmy Savile, please. And I go, and I go, Sam, I said, I've got a skeleton key to Stoke Mandeville Hospital.
It's a good job you move. You know, you have more arrows to your bow, strings to your bow, isn't it? Because like most of the, I mean, about Frank Spencer's the only one you can still do that isn't in that so far.
No, it's funny. All the people I used to impersonate have all been arrested. Yeah. Yeah, that because I mean,
makes me wonder if you were doing it and then. Is a film in that?
You mean when I bring up girls and do deep breathing when I go. Can you tell what it is?
Yeah.
It's my penis. That's in case you didn't get that joke. I know. There's a lot of who else is there? Yeah, I mean, there's lots of. But I mean, remember the when Bill Roach?
Yeah.
Was but the defendants in that case kept calling him Ken Barlow in court. Yeah, Ken Barlow came up to me. Touched me bum in the lift.
It's time for another emergency question. I might go old school. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock? And did people cheer as you did?
It's funny, I've got two dogs and they clearly can.
Yeah.
So they're all, not mine. You were going to jump on that, weren't you? You were like, yo, you mean your cock?
That's the headline in the Daily Mail tomorrow. That's sorted.
Yeah. No, they'll say Coogan has dogs suck his cock in inverted commas. Like, just a quote. Right.
Yeah.
No, I don't, by the way, just for the record. Hardly ever.
There's the danger of biting with the dog as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, exactly. It's not
I imagine.
It's not worth doing. It's not worth having to make something up at A&E, you know. I fell on my dog's mouth, you know. I think the idea occurs to you when you're younger.
Yeah.
That might be, you know, worthwhile. But it's just not possible. Have I tried? I probably did bend over once when I was about 40 and thought this is not going to happen. But
it is.
But
dogs, some people can do it. It is possible.
Dogs do. I mean, there's that old Mike Harding joke, isn't there? About I'm deliberately stealing his material here. Where he said he was at his girlfriend's house and the dog was licking its own balls, and he said it was a bit embarrassing because he was with his girlfriend and they were all staring at the dog licking its own balls, and he tried to break the ice by saying, "Well, I wish I could do that." And his girlfriend's mother said, give him a chocky bicky, I might let you.
You are quoted as saying, I'm not Mother Teresa, but I'm not Frank Both either. What other people aren't you?
And there's a series of slightly faded 1970s sports presenters that I'm also not.
You're not loads of people.
Yeah, I know. I just chose to randomly.
And have you seen The Wolf of Wall Street, the film, the movie The Wolf
yeah,
of Wall Street?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Does that, because I imagine if you...
What, have I done bad things?
Have you, I imagine, you know, did you look at that and go, yeah...
I actually, I've
thrown a dwarf at a dartboard. I've made a woman shave her head for $10,000.
Like I've never made a woman shave her head. Anyway, I have done cocaine, and I'm not very proud of that. Feel the silence. but you know, and I don't anymore, and I don't drink or anything now. But yes, I had an excessive time. But I actually, two things. One, I think The Wolf of Wall Street is fucking rubbish.
Yeah, that is the main problem.
That's the main problem.
It's over long.
It's so long. It's like, it says at the end. He got out of prison and he's still being a bastard. Yeah. And I was like, I don't want him to get out of prison. I want him to stay there forever.
Well, nobody really gets any. A couple of them die, but are not off the bar screen. But none of them get any repercussions. He goes to a cushy prison.
I don't care about anyone. This film's too long. It's just a load of rubbish.
And there's a bit where the policeman who caught him is sitting on the tube.
And you're supposed to think that, look at him, that policeman is really moral. He gets the tube every day. Ha 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 ha. What a loser. I just hated it. Yeah. But as regards some of the things that occurred in it, you know, I'm not Mother Teresa. But then again, I'm not Frank Boff.
Poor old Frank Boff. At the time, I came up with a joke. Most people don't know who he is. But no one ever laughed at this joke, but I'll do it now and hope we'll get some laugh 25 years later. Too many Cokes spoil the Boff. Come on!
That's good, that.
That is
good.
A fucking good job. Thank you.
That's how you went to that posh university.
No one liked it at the time. I'll do another emergency question. I want to know about... this is a good one. Where do you get your crazy ideas from?
From inside my head.
Oh, okay.
It was someone said, you just say from some woman who lives in Southport. You yeah. Know. Do you really want to know the answer to that
no.
question?
No.
Fuck for that.
I was very rude to both Ted Rogers and Don Estelle when I was a teenager, when I saw them in real life. Were you ever rude to a celebrity when you were a child?
I don't like being... I don't think you should bully people who are defenceless, and I would put Ted Rogers and Don Estelle in that camp, especially as they're dead. I think you should take the piss out of people who are empowered and think they're it, like the Top Gear presenters, for
yes.
example. So people who've got a bit too cocky and confident, they're the people you should, and people who've got money and power, you should take the piss out of them. You shouldn't take the piss out of blind beggars.
That's a very rude way to talk about Don Estelle. He was short-sighted for sure, but he sold his tapes in Woolworths, a good and honest man. So, well, let's talk a little bit about Alan Partridge, my creation, and the thing I made up. You seem to have had a... Because the difficult thing about creating such a massive hit is that, you know, you feel like you want to escape it and do other things. Mm. And it felt like you wanted to do that for a while, but you seem there's a renaissance of it and you don't seem to be have that worry about it anymore.
Well, I mean, the answer to the question is it is a bit of an albatross, but it's what they call a high-class problem. You know, when I was at school, I wanted to do a character like John Cleese and be like do something like 40 Tales. That wouldn't be great to do a really funny character that everyone thinks is really funny. And I did that with Alan Partridge, with your help, thanks. And then you sort of think, well, then when you've done it, you think, well, what do I do now? And the thing is, even though it was successful, I didn't it still feels like I still like it. I still like, even though it stops people considering me for other things sometimes, or it did. It was. I still like the character. So when I wasn't doing it, I would still be walking around, you know, slightly, in a slightly mad way, looking in shop windows, thinking, oh, I wonder what Alan would think of that. So I thought, I want to do some more, you know. Yeah. And also, when you write him, you get sick of him. When I wrote with Armando, you get. It's like literally being in a room with Alan Partridge for months. And so not in the end, it stops being nice. It's not funny anymore. It's just like in the room with a dick. And then eventually you think, well, I don't want to do it. And then when, of course, you go away, you think, oh, I quite miss him. He was a bit of a dick, but he was quite funny. And so then you come back to him. But what happened was I got lumbered with him. So I wanted to do. I wanted to do something different, but not get rid of Alan. And the more I did a few different things over the years with varying degrees of success. Probably the most satisfying thing I did was work with Michael Winterbottom, and I did a few films with him.
Yeah.
And that sort of stopped me going a bit mad and literally turning into Alan. but now since I did Philomena, which I did before Alan Partridge, when I did that before the Alan Partridge film, I did Philomena, and since that's been successful, it's opened other doors for me to do dramas now, dramas that have got a bit of comedy in them, and things that move people and touch people, not like Rolf Harris touch people, but touch people on an emotional level.
He sometimes did that as well.
Sometimes you touch them on an emotional level, you get to touch them physically. Yeah.
Just check their birth certificate.
Just check the birth certificate. I do. I won't take a photocopy. Anyway, the thing now. But when you do, I'm more likely to go back to Alan when I'm successful at other things. I'm more likely to actually do more Alan, if you like. You know what I mean?
But the recent stuff as well. Even though the early stuff was obviously fantastic, the bits I wrote especially, the recent bits. I think the autobiography, which I read and listened to on the audio and the audio version of it. Yeah. I don't think that's made me laugh more than anything else. I think that you've done with Alan Partridge is just. It's
very,
so
very dense with laughs. It is, I'm really pleased with that, because when you get offered to do a book, you know, what happens is, one thing that motivates you to make sure it's funny, well, first of all, Rob and Neil Gibbons, I always say the Gibbons write the material, people think I'm talking about monkeys, of course I'm not. I call Rob and Neil Gibbons their brothers, and they write, they're the sort of chief writers now on Partridge, and they're really great. And when we got the book, I didn't want to do that thing, you know, you get, sometimes you think, they get a book, you get a book deal, and it's a way of making quick money, and it can be cynical, and also, I always imagine sometimes that there's loads of people sort of rubbing their hands together in this country, especially. There's lots of people who love what you do, but there's also a few people rubbing their hands together going, oh, I hope it's shit. Right? And it's always nice to disappoint those people.
Yes.
So we just made sure it was really, really funny, and also made it seem really real. The problem is when you write comedy about a character who's been around for a long time, a lot of internet nerds who'll say, oh, you got that wrong. You said in 1992 that he shopped at Woolworths, and he's saying you to jump on Asda. And so what you have to do is, we had a researcher who made sure, go back through all the things to make sure it was all, you know, all stacked up. But it was...
But I suppose it's kind of, as well, when you were first doing it, you were like in your mid-20s. And so and now you're an older man and a middle-aged man, and that's more...
It's more... Do you know, when I was younger, like when I used to do gigs with you at universities and stay in halls of accommodation, I seem to remember, I started doing characters... I was doing impersonations then, and a bit after that I started doing characters. All the characters I did... I did like Paul and Pauline Carf and some this safety officer guy, and they were all really middle-aged people. And I remember thinking when I was younger, thinking, "Well, I can't wait to be middle-aged because then I'll be able to do." They'll look realistic, and rather than it's sort of, when I look at Alan Partridge now, when I was 26 with my hair combed over and a moustache, I'm going, "Oh, yeah, I'm middle." It's a bit rubbish. Sort of.
Well, and also, I think there's more tragedy to it when you're 25, you don't really, you know, you can look at older people and go, idiots.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you are sort of in your late 40s or whatever, you understand your own tragedy.
Well, what it sort of happened, in a way, that you're right there, but what's happened with Alan is, Alan was someone we used to laugh at, go, ha, 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 he's really funny, let's all take the piss out of him. And then as the years have gone on, and I've become closer to him, and sort of merged a bit half into him, like I'm sort of, like the fly when you're in a pod. sort of half of me is Alan Partridge. And so, and you start to become defensive and you sort of think, well, actually, I don't want to laugh at him. I want to, and so a lot of the humour is sort of, we're a bit more compassionate about Alan now than we were 20 years ago. So we're trying to sort of feel sorry. People feel a bit of sympathy for him now, whereas years ago they just laugh at him. Now they go, oh dear, poor Alan. You know. So, and that's kind of because it's sort of a bit more, it's probably become a bit more like me. And also when you're middle-aged, you're sort of, it's part of the catharsis, you sort of laugh at yourself. And things Alan says are sometimes things I think secretly. Yeah. Yeah. But then go, you can't say that. So I'll say it as Alan. And it's quite enjoyable.
Like what, Steve? What are the things that you...
I'll leave that for people to...
Because he says some awful things, so I'll just assume it's the most awful ones is what you actually... It is. Unless you point them out. Because we're doing these characters, it's very... When I knew you when we were younger, I thought it was very difficult to get to the heart of you as a person. And like, a lot of character... actors, I think you're very much, you're sort of the Peter Sellers of our generation, which is like a massive compliment in lots of ways. But
I'm not nasty to my kids.
No, that's good.
Or indeed a cunt.
No, but he was also he was a bit of an enigma as a person, as a human being. You know, because of the characters.
Well, I didn't know quite who early on. I didn't really. I suppose it didn't really have much of a personality. I just liked to do funny voices.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't really have any opinions or anything. I just liked doing funny voices. I'd never had a proper job. And I like to do, hide behind characters. But, you know, as the years have gone on, I've developed a personality.
But I find it so fascinating with the different levels of success that people have in their careers, and some deservedly so and some undeservedly so. And also a lot of people in this business can become very focused on the job and not on their home life and whatever. So you've obviously got a daughter and...
Yeah, I've got a daughter, so a girlfriend, two dogs.
And, two dogs who lick their own cocks.
What I don't do is I don't hang around with celebrities.
Yeah.
I really don't do that. And I sort of, a lot of people do, and I understand why some people do, because they think, well, they understand what it's like to be famous. I don't do that because I just don't feel comfortable doing that.
I don't think it is that though either. I don't think that's why they do it.
Why do you think
they do it? Because it's like it's an affirmation thing. It's like, look,
well,
see,
people say,
no one liked me at school, but look at me now with Robbie Williams.
I feel slightly uncomfortable about it. It's sort of like an invitation. I got an invitation to Elton John's birthday party once. I thought, why is he inviting me to his birthday party?
Well, it is, but that is odd. It's odd to invite. You know, you wouldn't do it as a. You wouldn't do it as a regular person. You wouldn't invite just another builder in another town. Yeah. Better invite to my birthday.
I know it's very odd. I do get the train into London, go to the office every day when I'm writing, and I'm not saying I'm horny handed son of toil, but I just try. I think it's.
Would you say you are a ham-handed son of
a ham-fisted daughter of something? So it's important to have a life and not be.
Are you happy in yourself, Steve?
I'm a lot happier than I was because I'm doing really well.
You are doing very well.
And that helps.
It is. I imagine it does.
Oh, come on. No. Don't say that.
Have you got your own podcast in a 400-seater theatre that fills up some weeks, not other weeks? Kind of inexplicably.
No. I forgot the question now.
No, that wasn't what the man. We can rewind and listen to it later and go, that's what it was. You're doing a lot more writing at the moment. You're doing some writing and
I'm trying to write some more films.
Yeah.
And produce films, get some other people to write them.
Yeah.
So I don't have to. And a bit of acting in some things that I haven't written. Just try and mix it up a bit. Try and you know, try and do different. But it's, I'm very happy because I'm doing what I wanted to do, which is I love comedy, but I'm more interested in using comedy to make people think about things, rather than just laugh. Laughing is good, but if you laugh and think at the same time, it's better.
I agree with that. But you, and I think you're sort of moving, because this seemed to happen a decade ago to a lot of, someone would be successful in the UK, and then they go to America, and they do kind of much broader comedy.
Well, I sort of did that for a bit, and it was a mistake. It was I did. You know, I was in a thing called The Other Guys, and I played, you know, Wheel Number 5, and you sort of, and you know, other it's. And I had an agent who said, you need to be in a comedy with Vince Vaughn. And I fired him because I just realized I was sort of doing what I hated.
Yeah.
Because other people... When I did Philomena, I spotted a story in the newspaper and I thought, well, that would be a really interesting film. And the first time I did something where I ignored the advice you get. I just did my own thing. And I thought, well, from now on, I'm going to just do what I think I want to do. And also, if you do what you believe in and you fail, then you've still got a bit of dignity. If you sell your soul and still fail, then you're really fucked.
You get lots of money and stuff though, I imagine.
Not if you fail.
No
money or self-respect. I mean, you know, I've got a lot of self-respect. My self-respect is for sale, but it's very, very high price.
And did you feel that putting Jackie Chan in Around the World in 80 Days was...
Obviously, you know, I'd done Michael Winterbottom films to please people, but then I had to satisfy my own muse. So I thought working with Jackie Chan would really stretch myself and would be, you know, because I think people have to suffer for their art.
Because I read that book and I thought it needs more kind of martial arts and stuff in it. Yeah. That's what it... It's all very well going around the world in 80 days, but where's the fighting?
He had someone on set who peeled grapes for him. A woman's job to peel grapes for him.
Because he was too weak to do it himself.
And then I tasted them and thought, well, that's really nice.
Do you think the person who peels his grapes goes home and thinks, I have self-respect? Yeah, I'm Jackie Chan's grape peeler. That's my role in life.
Well, probably not.
No. It's an interesting job to have. Okay, well, we're near at the end because I'm conscious of you, you know, having to get trains.
I am. I've got to go back to Brighton.
He's going on a train. You could, if you go and stand in the station, you can get him. Yeah. I don't like kill him.
Yeah. If you get the train to Brighton, I'll be getting on it, and you know, I'll say hello, and then you'll go and sit in standard, and I'll go and sit in first class. Because I like to mix with real people. You know.
Have you ever bumped into
stockbrokers?
Have you ever bumped into Nick Cave at Brighton Station?
I've bumped into Nick Cave a lot on the train.
Because I sat next to him in Brighton Station.
It's funny. It's funny. You do actually. I tell you once, I bumped into Chris Eubank on the first class compartment, and he went. He leant forward. He went, "You're a very funny man, aren't you?" Well, some people think so. Yes, I thought you were a comedian because of the way you were eating your sandwich. I wasn't eating it in a funny way. And he went, yes, I know. I'm just saying. It's really odd.
I bumped into Tam Dyle the other day, and he. No, he just made that up so he could do the impression. That's bullshit. That's
honestly the truth. So, who else? Other famous people I've seen on the train to Brighton.
Yeah.
Victor Spinetti, no longer with us.
Oh yes.
Wycliffe's Dover.
Vera Lynn
saw her. Dora O'Brien.
Is there a ghost train you're on from the 1920s?
It is. It actually goes all the way to the pier and then goes like that. Yeah. And anyone else?
Chris Eubank's an interesting person because he's sort of I'd forgotten about him and then because he was everywhere for a while when he was good at boxing.
Well, he did actually just come up to me and say, "Do you think do you think I would be good at acting?" And I said, "Within your range." a boxer with a cane and a monocle, definitely first in line.
he could play himself in the Chris Eubank story. He said he could never, he was so masculine, he could never produce a female child. That's what I remember about him saying.
Really?
He said he would never have a daughter because he was so masculine.
Really?
He didn't really understand genetics. Chris Eubank, he was good at boxing, and he then did have a female child. But that's my favourite thing about Chris Eubank. I was going to ask if you ever seen a ghost, but we've established that you have on the special Harry Potter train to Brighton. You get the celebrity. There's a different train that goes to Brighton. It's just the celebrity one. You have to go walk through platform to get there. Have you ever seen a Bigfoot in real life?
No, I haven't. No, I don't believe in that.
Well, it doesn't matter. You have to believe in it.
There was an episode of The $6 Million Man that had Bigfoot in it. Do you
That's
remember
right.
that?
I do, yeah.
I think it was in two parts.
I think you're right, it was. Have you ever seen a $6 Million Man in real life?
No.
Yeah, probably.
But,
you
know, bionics, I mean, it's becoming real, isn't it?
Yeah, so Bigfoot might be real.
Oscar Pistorius, he's got the bendy false legs.
We're going now, let's do the impression of Oscar Pistorius. Shall I do one?
I couldn't find my boing legs, my lady.
I can do an impression of Oscar Pistorius.
Across the bedroom.
Shall I do Oscar Pistorius? This is my Oscar Pistorius. That's him failing to ask her if she's in the bathroom.
It's good that you can make comedy out of tragedy.
It is. How long is that trial going to go? Why don't they understand about the Oscar Pistorius thing, right? They had the trial, they had a pre-trial, they had the trial, he had to go away to hospital a bit because he was a bit tired. Then they came back and then they said, right, yeah, we've got the... You're going to have to come back in a month and we'll tell you what the sentence is going to be. And then I thought, oh, today will be the sentence. And then that was all day and more witnesses coming in. How long is it going to go on for? Are they going to eke this out? It's disgraceful. Just tell me what's happening to Oscar Pistorius.
I agree.
Steve Coogan, tell me. You know, no, you're all celebrities together. Well, we're nearly at an end. I'll let you go in a second. I feel like there was something else I should have talked to you about. Fuck it. You're not on Twitter.
No, I don't do. Well, I'm a bit scared because I think I'll say something that I'll lose my temper and say something and then have to, you know, apologise.
Yeah, it's all right. Don't apologise, that's what I do.
I know, but then what if you say something that was really mean and you actually want to apologise, but you don't really want
say
to?
Say something meaner.
But if everyone was like that, we would live in a horrible world, wouldn't we?
That's what Twitter is at the moment. you'll eventually end up in prison. People will see you go, oh, I thought they were a cunt, but they're just terribly sad people. Yeah. okay, look, I think we will. I want to end on a big question, and I'm, you know, I can't think of one. It's kind of it's a downside on being an interviewer. When you, if your penis could travel in time, but just your penis through a little hole like that,
yeah.
Where would you send your penis? It would still be attached to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not just going to go off and then your penis is flopping around on the floor somewhere like a fish that's just come out of an ocean.
Okay.
It's going to be attached to you.
Okay.
But then from the perspective where it is in time, it's just like a floating
penis. I can feel the sensations that happen to the penis.
Yeah, so it could go anywhere in time and do anything you want.
Anything I wanted to.
Yeah, with the consent of the other person involved.
But how, would, you'd that, have to, but how would that be arranged?
You'd pass a little... you'd have to... Put a
write something on the penis saying, "Can I have sex with you?" And then she tapped it twice. It would be a she, by the way. So I'm not gay.
You wouldn't know it. It's like a time traveling glory hole. Anything could be on the other side. There could be a dog on the other side of that.
Well, no. But if I've got choice, then I'd probably have sex with someone like Brigitte Bardot in 1955.
Okay. She's still alive, isn't she?
I know. So I still go back in time. No.
What's wrong with Brigitte Bardot now?
She's too old.
Wow. There's nothing... The one thing worse than a paedophile is a gerontophile, Steve Coogan. That's quite specific. A few people get checking their dictionaries, they're going to be laughing in about 5 minutes of that.
I'm with Tony Curtis. I could never go out with anyone old enough to be my wife.
Right.
Ooh. Sorry.
I would criticise you for it, but my wife is 13 years younger than I am, so I'm slightly stuck on. I would go, yeah, that's you going out with young women just because you can. oh no, it's turned nasty at the end. But mainly, we're getting on okay. It's just the audience haters. Just the audience have turned
anger,
against us.
Anger.
Both. are you going to bring back Tony Farino?
Oh God! That, do you know who might? Do you know? Interestingly enough, no is the answer.
Okay.
But,
but
when I was doing that, my A&R guy was Simon Cowell.
Wow!
He was the person who was handling me.
Yes,
as it were. And the person who taught me to do the choreography for me was Bruno Thingione, the
from
Strictly Come Dancing or whatever. And he also taught me to walk like Pauline Calf, because he said to me once, Steve, you look great, you look fantastic, but you walk like a bloke. He said you have to walk like this. You know, and he did this sort of female walk up and down, wiggling his bum, and said, and I practiced it. You know, practiced walking up and down, one foot in front of the other, and one foot literally in front of the other, and sort of wiggling. He said, "Now I said I want you to walk in all the things that I've taught you. I want you to walk up and down, but inside your head, I want you to think. I want you to say to yourself, I want you to fuck me." That was his professional advice.
It worked. Did he get any percentage?
I gave him £50 in cash.
He invented Pauline Calf. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please give a massive round of applause for my guest, Steve Coogan? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre Podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Steve Coogan. The music was by Pest. Thanks to Orange Mark at the British Comedy Guide and the staff at the Leicester Square Theatre. And to Chris Evans, not that one, not the one from the Avengers, not the one who plays golf, I expect. It was produced by Ben Walker. It's a Fuzz, Go Faster, Stripe.com and Sky Potato production. Thanks. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. If you want to contribute, go to www.gofasterstripe.com/badges, or you can buy a DVD from gofasterstripe.com. Check out the sale that's on at the moment as well. I think it should still be running. There's lots of bargains in there. Or why not buy a ticket to come and see me on tour, richardherring.com/lotds/tour. We'll give you all the dates of everywhere I'm coming in the new year. There's a few dates, and I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre in the first week of December, so why not book a ticket if you live in London to come and see me there. Thanks for listening. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Now I must go. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And
would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.